G'day expats and welcome to another episode of Expat Chat, episode 18. Join with me today is my friend and colleague James Ridley, who's the Managing Director for Atlas in the APAC region, and myself, I'm based in Dubai and look after expats in the Europe, Middle East and Africa region. G'day James.
G'day Brett, how are you going over there? Looks like you're still working from home at the moment, so in and out of the office.
Mate, I've been upgraded from the dining room table. I'm up into, an open landing upstairs now. My family finally returned home, for those who have been following at home. So arrived back on Saturdays. Both the girls are about another foot taller, like we were discussing before. And
that's right.
Fantastic to have them home. So we've been essentially home quarantining while they've been back. Impressively, when they landed, they had their PCR test, and 12 hours later, we actually got a text message saying all clear. So they've actually done a brilliant job in doing those tests and coming back. So, but we're just being cautious. You know, we're just going to give it a week, make sure there's no symptoms, and then we'll be out and about doing our thing. So how's things back in Oz?
Listen, I don't want to rub it in. It's pretty good in Queensland. Obviously, I'll touch on that soon. Victoria's in a bit of trouble.
We're going to play the Victorian game, yeah?
let's lean on it. I mean, I think I was watching the telly this morning that I think another 77 cases overnight are reported, before that 70 and then before that 65. So I think there's a few hundred cases that are active in Victoria at the moment, and that, you know, bordering states have obviously closed their borders and trying to keep it all in. But yeah, Victoria's in a bit of trouble at the moment.
And on a cruise ship in sight.
Exactly right. Exponential growth at the moment in Victoria, so be watching it closely. But it seems like, you know, they're doing everything correctly. They're locking down suburbs. I think they've locked down 36 suburbs now, where it's almost got gridlock. You know, you're not allowed to leave. Yep. There was funny reports of how Victorian locals were trying to change their address so they could go out and travel, which is just somewhat irresponsible.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly right. So that's how I suppose Victoria's doing. And you know, Queensland, we're very lucky, actually. As of tomorrow, July 3rd, they have eased restrictions again, and we can finally have quite a few people at venues, you know, restaurants, bars, gyms. So we'll see how long that lasts. Hopefully, it just keeps getting better and better. And I suppose that's probably a reflection of Australia as well. You know, Australia's doing really, really well in some
They've done parts. A great job. Yeah, they've done a great job. And I think a lot of countries around the world are envious of, you know, their numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we talked a long time ago about, okay, well, Australia's sort of heading into winter. Is that going to play a bit of a part here about whether that's going to make it fuel? Yeah, exactly right. Fuel it a bit. But it seems like it hasn't, you know. Most states, excluding Victoria, done really, really well, and cases are dropping, or they've got zero, recorded cases, which is outstanding. And I wonder if that's starting to translate to our local economy. You know, you're looking at sort of, you know, the share market and those sort of things. Before we actually go on, Brett, I'm not sure if we actually touched on that disclaimer.
No, we need to get a recorded jingle or something. Yeah, you know, something more exciting than my dulcet tones of just telling everyone that do not take any information that you see, hear, or read in this podcast or vlogcast or what do you want to call it, however you're consuming it, as personal information. Treat it as your Sunday fun, but it's certainly not the case for assuming this is as personal advice.
I'll have to go back and interpret that another way.
Long story short, don't take this as gospel for what your situation
that's
is.
That's right.
It's fun and games only.
That's right, mate. But I guess, yeah, I mean, you know, talking about maybe a general market update, you know, we've closed out the financial year here in Australia, obviously, as of the 30th of June. Big changes. Main residence exemption gone the way of the dodo now, so that's all.
Yeah, despite our best efforts.
That's right. Who knows what's going to happen in the future there, but that's all gone. So you sell your property as a non-resident as of now, as of yesterday. Be careful, as you could be in
your toast
in terms of capital gains tax. That's right. We're not going to go into it because we've recorded probably hours of that, as well as written too many blogs on it. That's right, but it's now in effect in full. In terms of, now that it's a new financial year, you know, consider your strategy, a bit of a strategy reset, what you're doing to prepare for your eventual retirement. But I mean, you know, let's take a step back. Market update. I mean, it seemed like we saw a bit of a rally towards the end of the financial year last week or two. And I mean, we just said then the market's up, 1.6%. So is this a sign that we're going to continue on and keep crawling out of this?
to me, you almost have to ignore the last week of the financial year, because there is what's called window dressing by fund managers. So they want to balance up their books. They want to close off positions. You know, their mandate and how they manage money is on a quarterly basis. So they have certain parameters they have to follow and maintain while managing money. And they may not be able to carry over certain positions into the following quarter or the following financial year. So we do get that ruling off period. So honestly, I've never looked at the market for the last week of June for the basic fact that it's all smoke and mirrors anyway. Obviously today, look, it's an interesting one, and we will go through this for those listening who are clients. We've obviously got our webinar happening next week, which is a client-only webinar. It's a deep dive into property, currency, and equity markets. We're going to go into a lot of detail and almost dissect who the participants are in the market right now. And should we be sucking into this FOMO rally, or should we sit back and wait as patient money? It's so much so that ASIC actually put out a report on their concern about the number of retail investors in the market in May.
They did. Yeah, you're right.
And it was quite an alarming report, you know, and it really broke down, you know, any time, well, I think it was in one day of a retail, and retail we're referring to mum and dad investors, within one day of a retail person buying a share, more than likely, I mean, it was 80% of the time, it would be down the following day. And then any time that they would sell a share, it'd be up the following day. And it was just really highlighting that mum and dad investors don't have the, I guess, the acumen to be able to properly manage money in a day trading capacity in this type of market. If I look back at the people who I highly respect in terms of money managers, you know, Carl Icahn's, the Warren Buffett's of the world, you know, they're cash heavy, and you know, as are we. And I think that's, you can't expect, you know, we're over 6,000 today. You can't expect the biggest economic event since World War II to be done and dusted by 30 June and the market to be only down 1,000 points from 7,000. It's just... Everything that's in my DNA of being in the markets for pretty much the last, you know, 24 years is just screaming at me saying it's not over.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's funny, you make a good point there about the retail investors back in May and some of those reports that came out. I remember having a catch up with a client and they're saying that they're sitting down with their bank broker via a Zoom call, getting a bit of an update on interest rates and, you know, locking things in, whether it's, you know, net bank saver or term deposit, those sort of things. And the broker is, doesn't actually provide sort of financial advice. He's more of a personal banker. He's like, well, are you buying shares? Are you buying bank shares? You know, this is your opportunity to get in at such a good price. And, you know, not actually giving them advice, but saying these things is enough to make those type of retail investors go, you know, oh, shit, okay, I've got to buy in. But at the end of the day, if there's a huge drop again in 1 month, 2 months, those are the first individuals that are going to be selling out at the bottom and just cause that flow-on effect, snowball effect. So it's those type of individuals or bankers, brokers, whatever you want to call them, that really do somewhat grind my gears, because they're placing ideas in individuals' heads and then they're just going out and doing it because, oh, here, I'll help you set up a ComSec account. Oh, I'll speak to this broker, go and do this, go and do that. But they're the people that are first going to sort of collapse when there is a bit of a drop.
It's when you start getting stock tips from Uber drivers and taxi drivers, that's when you know it's not good. And it is that case. It is seems to be across the board. It is what I call racetrack money. You know, it is people taking a punt. When you look at Robinhood, you know, their account numbers, when you look at, sorry, to explain to people on the, you know, on the call.
Yeah, you might flesh that out a bit.
Robinhood is a robo-advisor in the US where you can virtually put money into account and it will do all the investing automatically for you, which is a very, you know, from a UI point of view, user experience point of view, it is amazing. But their numbers are up 2,500% since March. So it is Mr. and Mrs. Smith from Idaho with $10,000 having a go times how many, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. And it's not sticky money. It's not fast money. Sorry, it's not stable sticky money. It's not people taking long-term positions. It's people jumping in. And if you look at the numbers and the reports that have come out, you know, all these people bought all the airlines, Hertz, you know, all these sort of companies when they started going to Chapter 11. And then...
Yeah.
These stocks were going up 200-400% on the back of nothing, on the back of smoking, you know, just hopes and dreams. And then they started trading it and they were going back and forth, back and forth, back. Yeah, so it really, it sets them up for quite a nasty shock when we do start to get this, you know, July to us and August is the crunch month. That's when we get the real hard data. That's right. US companies That's right. reporting their second quarter results, Australian companies reporting the 30 June results. It's going to be, there's no hiding from the numbers. And look, the numbers may not be as bad as we think it might be. And in that case, the market may be justified being where it is, but it may be worse.
That's right. I mean, as I was saying to you before, Brett, I'm somewhat glad we're not in the US and we, well, there's probably a few reasons why I'm glad, but I'm not in the US right now. But one of the main reasons is you look at the NASDAQ, you look at the S&P 500, and they're just going bananas. NASDAQ's, you know, historical high. It's rallied. It's, you know, at its highest point it's ever been. And there's nothing really driving that except for potentially still those tech stocks, which, again, it's not broad participation, as you said before. It's a narrow participation. There's gaps there. There could be a little bubble that's built up there, which, you know, would be nice if people, you know, obviously started to slow down a bit. But, I mean, there's a concern around that obviously it's been a bear market rally. Are we going to see another drop? Is the drop going to be more than what we saw? But I guess, a lot of that Q2 and Q4 data will tell and help paint a bit of a picture as well, and maybe give us some expectations of what we can sort of set up over the next quarter.
My biggest fear is that, yes, there's a truckload of stimulus being put into the market by both, you know, US, Australia, and all the other Federal Reserves. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the receivables in banks, in terms of their deposits are going through the roof, Australia deposits are going through the roof. And the consumer's not spending. You know, obviously the government's trying to release money to get it sloshing through. And I remember seeing a report out from CNBC a couple of weeks ago that said that US consumers are saving 33% of their disposable income. So it's all well and good to be pumping money, but they're not spending it. And then, I saw an article last week that said normally Australian banks can fund their mortgages, you know, their servicing and loans, you know, 30 to 40%. By deposits, they can fund it by 70% now.
Yeah, it's good cushion, so, isn't it?
Good cushion, very good cushion. But it means the banks don't have to go out and borrow money in the wholesale market to lend to Mr. and Mrs. Smith to get their mortgage for a house. Right. But what it tells you is that Australians are hoarding cash.
Yep, and it's going to cause a bit of a slowdown, obviously, and that's what's happening right now.
Exactly. I mean, look.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, this morning on the radio, they're talking about, on ABC, they're talking about all the issues with, okay, you know, you've got the JobKeeper payments going, you've got the JobSeeker payments going, but a lot of businesses, small businesses, are reporting, oh, we can't get workers back in because the JobSeeker payment is too high.
It's keeping them out, yeah.
Exactly right. There might be a difference there of, okay, that individual might work 25 to 30 hours, but if they go in and actually do work, they're only making an additional $100 to $200 a week. In their eyes, it's not worth it. So there's they're supposed to stay on for until the end of September, I think. So the government's really got to rethink that, because that just comes down to Australians being lazy. You know, we've all become lifestyle enthusiasts now. It's all about getting out and being active because we can. And it's a bit ridiculous, to be honest. It's a shame that we're starting to...
A bit of YOLO.
That's right. But they're just milking it for everything it's worth, and the government's going to have to rethink this. Otherwise, we're going to be stuck in this a lot longer.
I think the interesting one's going to be is obviously everything comes to a crunch in September. So JobKeeper, JobSeeker, mortgage holidays, rental eviction, moratorium, everything. And, you know, do we just fall off the cliff, or is there a petering out, like a reduced capacity to help people get through that? That's the big question. Because if they just suddenly cut everything off into September, you know, it's almost like, you know, a drug addicted person just coming off the drug straight away. There's going to be a shock. There's going to be not a good result. And it's how they manage that. And it'd be interesting to see, you know, July and August as we lead into September, how that goes. Because I don't think it's going to be as cut and dry. You're going to have a lot of people out there who don't have tenants or don't have jobs. So mortgage serviceability is going to be a major concern. Then there's also the companies that have been propped up by these, you know, initiatives for SMEs. And, you know, like we discussed in our last call, you know, companies being wound up have actually gone down. in this period. And the reason being is because the responsibility of directors trading a solvent has been sort of ignored.
That's right.
And all these things are going to come back in. So are we going to see a big run of companies suddenly becoming insolvent? Are we going to see, you know, I don't know. And that's the big thing that's in the back of my head. I love the fact that the market is going up, but I mean, that juxtaposition, like, it just, there's too much going on for it to be going up.
Well, I mean, it sounds like, you know, you might be sort of steering the way that, okay, are we propping ourselves up for further disaster in September when everything starts to roll back and people are forced to go and get work and all these grants, you know, GST, PAYG withholdings that small businesses are getting, they're pretty much, you know, they come to a halt and then business gone, you know, shit, cash is dried up. The business isn't there. People aren't spending. I hope the government's got a plan for the next 3 months because, you know, otherwise everyone's going to be going to insolvency, receivership, placing in administration. You can name them all.
Yeah, look, and look, I think it's, to me, it's you know, I think small business owners are the largest employer of Australians. I think it's
right,
huge.
Yep.
Is it 40 or 50, maybe 60%? I can't remember what the number is. It's a
lot. Oh, the workforce huge. Yeah.
And, you know, if SMEs are hit the hardest, which I suspect they may be through this whole period, because they don't have the cash reserves of a blue chip ASX company that's sitting on, you know, tens, hundreds of millions of dollars. So it's there's a bit more to play out here. And I think, you know, that's going to be something that certainly doesn't keep me up at night, but it keeps my attention focused anyway.
Yeah. I mean, whether it's a case, I mean, it's anyone's guess at the moment. There's a lot of disconnect what's going on in share markets, but whether it's a case the market doesn't sort of continue on its current trajectory where it seems to be recovering, but it just stays stagnant for the remainder of the year, or whether there's a pullback or for some reason it just keeps somewhat, you know, slowly crawling out of it. It's unusual, but I guess we'll gauge a lot of that from that Q2 and Q4 data, and hopefully that'll give us a bit of a report as well. So, you know, that's probably enough talking about a bit of a market update. We could probably talk about it and too many different things, to be honest. That's right. Yeah. Pull too many strings there. But I mean, I mentioned it before, you know, it's a new financial year now. So it means for most individuals, you know, if they're running a bit of their own individual strategy, personal strategy, they need to sort of look at, you know, what are they doing to prepare for their retirement or their repatriation, you know, looking at different asset classes. And I suppose, you know, when you consider that we've just been through a bit of a once in a lifetime event, you know, what lessons, you know, have we learned from this pandemic? I mean, you know, Brett, what's an example of some lessons that we've learned from this pandemic when it comes to assets, retirement, wealth accumulation, those sort of things?
Sitting where I'm sitting, liquidity is, you know, we've always talked about it, the importance of liquidity and the ability to manage risk, but now ever more so the ability of, you know, Australian expats to be able to put their hand on money if they need it. You know, we're seeing widespread redundancies and furloughs across just the most wide range of industries. And you have to fund that difference. You know, if you're being furloughed or you're being put on reduced pay, you need to fund that gap. And if you can't put your hand on 10, 20, 30, 40, 50,000, whatever that number is, in cash, then you've got a big problem. You can have all the assets in the world. There's that great saying about being asset rich, cash poor. You know, you can have three properties, you can have anything, but if you can't pay the bills, then you've got problems. And to me, that's probably the biggest one that everyone's talking about right now is, thank God I can get access to $10,000, $30,000 when I need it. Just to plug those gaps and get us through these tough times. I mean, how about yourself?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've seen a few different sort of situations which make me a bit nervous for the individuals. I've got a bit of, I suppose, a case at the moment, a new client. I guess you could call it a case study, you know. They were made redundant. They were a bit of a recruiter, a pretty good recruiter, to be honest, over in Singapore. And obviously now's not a time where people are hiring. So they were made redundant in their role. They've come back to Australia, and unfortunately they did seek advice from an offshore advisor who's sort of skewed majority of their wealth into these offshore products, you know, in their superannuation.
Not the executive savings plans and all that sort of nonsense.
It's a bit of a mixed bag, to be honest, and it's disappointing because they're 63, their superannuation has $50,000 in it, and all their other assets are locked up. You know, they've got probably just over, I think, million across, you know, international investment accounts over in Singapore, some savings bonds or savings plans, I think they're promoted as, but just, you know, investment bonds. And because recruitment's pretty hard to get into back in Australia now, given, I suppose, the state of the local economy as well, you know, they're at that age where, yeah, okay, they've actually got assets there where if it was all within super or back in Australia, they could probably actually have a comfortable retirement and start drawing down from it out of super. But their assets are all, I suppose, structured
locked up
very incorrectly. Exactly right. I mean, now that they're back in Australia as well, they have, you know, they've changed their tax residency. They're residing in Australia. So now they've got the additional issue. Okay, well, how will the ATO want to, firstly, you know, let's go on, let's talk about the bonds. How is the ATO going to treat these bonds when they finally are able to withdraw them, or if they break them early, you know, they get hit with a penalty? You know, are they going to be the, you know, the foreign investment fund rules whereby, you know, contributions aren't taxed that we've made, but all the capital growth for the entire period that they've owned that, whether it's the last 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
Exactly right. So that's not very tax efficient because that's, you know, 5 to 10 years worth of capital gains that are now taxed compared to the opposite of accumulating wealth back in Australia in direct shares where it wouldn't have been taxed at all.
That's right.
You know, that's one example.
The
other issue, currency risk. I mean, you could talk about this all day, currency risk, you know.
Yep.
All their assets are now in a foreign currency. So in the event we have a bit of a another issue with this pandemic and there's a second wave that sweeps the globe, all the currencies are just going to be going wild, you know. Or you look at the Australian dollar. The Australian dollar got down to 58 cents. I think the Singaporean dollar got down up to $1.14 at one stage, maybe a bit higher. Australian dollar is now back up to almost 70. So a lot of the wealth that she had has actually changed because of the currency fluctuations. Now I've got to work out ways, okay, well, if they can't get work and they're going to be retiring now to source income streams.
How do you fund it?
To also look at, how do you fund it? Exactly right. Okay. Yeah. We can work on after-tax contributions to super, you know, making large non-concessional contributions up to 100,000. But because she's 63, we can only do that up in
for another 2 years.
Legislation, which hopefully is changing, where it might be up to 66. But that means, okay, if we trigger the bring forward rule, there's 300,000 we can get in. If we do it before a financial year, we might be able to get 100, then 300, there's 400,000. Need to wait another 2 financial years after you trigger the bring forward rule, then you can do it again. However, she'll be well over 65 by then. Yep. If she's not working, she can't squash any more money in there. So now that income stream that she's going to be drawing from potentially foreign sources now 100% taxable by the ATO, and it's highly likely there's not going to be a foreign tax credit there either. So you can see that these situations, and I mean, these offshore advisors, they really grind our gears because...
Well, where are they? Like 6 years down the track, 7 years down the track, 5 years down the track after signing up to these things and you're trying to manage, you know, your finances, where are these advisors, you know, in inverted commas?
That's right.
They're long gone.
Yeah.
Well, you know, they've gone back to selling used cars or, you know, used rugs or, you know, they're just not there. And
well, I mean, remember the incentives.
Responsibility. Yeah.
That's right. Remember the incentives that they're given. I mean, if they're signing up to just an investment account or let's say an investment bond, if it's an investment bond, they get paid a very large upfront commission.
Huge. It can be in the tens of thousands of dollars, US dollars.
Yeah, well, that's right. And, you know, there's also a trail there that they'll receive from the commissions for as long as you are maintaining that, you know, that bond or that savings plan for 10, 15, 25 years. The investment accounts, because they're obviously usually over in Singapore or the Asias, they actually receive commissions from the specific managed funds or ETFs they put you in. You know, there's usually an upfront trail straight away.
They get sometimes a nice 5% upfront commission on that. So
that's right.
They can load. And, you know, I've heard of cases where, you know, these advisors are earning $200,000 a month.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if they've got a big enough book of, you know, expats on them, not just from Australia, but obviously worldwide. Absolutely. But you can see that, you know, they might lean on expats' insecurities in terms of...
They know, the pain points. I've actually, believe it or not, received telemarketing calls myself. And I let it go just to see, you know, what they... And they, you know, they have sales trainers coming in. They know... That they're not very smart on the finance side, but they're very smart on the sales tactics, and they know the question, the leading questions to ask that throws doubt in your mind to try and get you across the line. And you know, it's you know, I was quite horrified when I've had three so far since living here, and what they can say and get away with is downright fraud. And when I sort of popped my head up and made them aware of who I was and what I know, they were gone. But that's the that's the biggest issue that I always talk about with, you know, when sitting down with people is, you know, this is where we're very proud of what we offer. You know, as a fiduciary firm, legally, and that's the biggest word I can, you know, sort of stress, we have to have your best interests. You can sue us if we don't have your best interests. None of these other firms have that responsibility. They can sign you up, and then once you sign up, bang, they're on to the next victim, and off they go. But there's no, you know, you signed up, so it's your consent, as opposed to if you sign up with us and we've still done wrong, you can still sue us.
Accountability.
And yeah, accountability is massive. Yeah.
I mean, and I suppose anyone that's listening out there now that's sort of, you know, thinking about retirement planning, you know, remember, you know, if we get to say age 60, technically we've got only another 5 years that we can get, you know, contributions or after-tax contributions into super. So if a lot of your wealth or retirement assets are sitting outside of super, whether it's in cash or offshore funds, whatever it might be, you've really got to start, you know, putting the hammer down and go, okay, well, shit, I'm planning on retiring and coming back soon. I need to work out how to get this into super. The reason why you want to consider super is, well, it's very tax efficient. When we draw an income stream from it, a full account-based pension, and we're fully retired, the investment earnings within super are tax-free. The income stream that we draw out of it is tax-free. If we're investing in ASX blue chip shares that pay fully franked dividends, we get franking credit refunds, which again, tax-free. So that's helping build the account as well. So it's really
maintaining your own best.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And you're in ASX blue chips and spread across quite a lot there. So in the event you need access to capital for those sort of ad hoc once-off expenses.
As long as the market's open, you can sell.
That's right. So you really need to start having a think there. You know, if you're sort of in your 50s, you're not sure, you need to really start, you know, planning for your retirement. Because at the end of the day, if there is another pandemic event like this, which we never thought there would be, some individuals, some smart individuals thought there would be, that we weren't ready for it, and they were right. I think Steve Jobs might have been one of them.
Bill Gates.
But Bill Gates, that's right. Sorry, that's right. He had that paper. But it just means that, okay, when you come back to Australia, your retirement assets aren't set up accordingly to retire within 3 years' time. You're going to have some serious issues there. We're trying to squash all that capital in there.
And also, I think, let's dispel a myth too, and I heard this in the last 2 weeks and it scared me. They've been telling people, in order to convince them to sign up to these plans, that you can physically move these into your super fund.
If you I've heard that about,
Yeah, and you cannot. You know, these things...
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a 1950s Volkswagen Beetle with a brand new body on it. It is, there's no transferability. There's nothing, you know, you could not have any more removed. The only time you get transferability into super is by way of a foreign pension. And this thing could not be any further from a foreign pension than it is.
But taking that a step further, I mean, I've looked at all the different foreign pensions. I've gone through the ATO's case studies. I've gone through their private rulings. Right now, the only portability scheme that exists, there's one via QROPS, UK pension. You still need to stay within the recommended limits, which makes it very difficult when your UK pension balance is over 300,000 Australian dollars and you need to go through a bit of a lengthy process. There's no normal Australian retail super funds which are currently registered. You have to have a self-managed super fund. You can't roll a foreign pension or a provident fund into an Australian superannuation fund. It's not acknowledged as a foreign pension or foreign super fund because the tax treatment and tax setup is completely different. The criteria to roll those funds or access those funds is completely different. Same with 401ks in the US, your IRAs, your Roths, completely different. You cannot roll them into an Australian super fund. If you do, or you pull it out and then try and recontribute, you've got to really think about the tax considerations. How's the IRS going to tax me on that lump sum withdrawal if I've accessed it before 59 and a half? How's the ATO going to tax me on that lump sum withdrawal now that I'm an Australian tax resident? Really
it's
need to be mindful
parts.
Of these kind of things.
It's those
That's
dots.
Right.
How do they line up? And, you know, like you and I always say, the conversation we have with an expat in the US is completely different to UK, UAE, Hong Kong, everyone's different, and there isn't that cookie cutter approach to these things, and you need to be mindful whether you're dealing with a pension, a 401k, or a provident fund. There's three completely different beasts. It is like buying a truck, a car, and a motorbike. You know, yes, they've all got wheels, but that's about the only similarity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, what, you know, what I said before about these offshore advisors, they lean on the insecurities of expats where, oh no, you can't send money back to Australia because they'll think you're a tax resident, or you can't do this in Australia because they'll think you're an Australian tax resident, and that means your tax-free income or your low tax income you're earning here will get taxed. It's not the case.
It's illegal to contribute to super. That's the big one they use here in the Gulf.
Oh, yeah, gosh.
It's illegal. Yeah, and it's just like, no. You know, almost want to get hire a plane to fly through the sky and sign right over Dubai so everyone can see you can contribute to super with a small line saying unless you have an SMSF. But apart from that, yeah.
That's right. I would say 98.9% of expats probably all have your traditional Australian retail super funds.
Yep.
You know, there's a very smaller percentage which maintain a self-managed super fund. But funnily enough, they've set up correctly so they don't actually contribute to it at all. It's usually, they've gone through a process there with solicitors, so it's set up. It's quite a lengthy and expensive process.
And if they do want to contribute to super, they just set up a retail fund on the side and they contribute to that. When they're back in Australia, then they merge it all back together again. Happy days.
Do a consolidation, exactly right. Those individuals that do have the SMSF, it's usually a case where they have to keep an SMSF because they've invested in property,
and
they can't just sell it and wind it up when they're leaving. So, the summary of what I'm trying to get home here is just if you're approaching retirement in the next 5, 10, 15 years, take a stock of your worldwide assets. Are they set up for a tax-efficient repatriation? Are they set up for a retirement that's going to be back in Australia? If they're not, you need to start planning. You need to start building. You need to start planning around that, setting a strategy, contributing to super, contributing to, maybe a family trust with a bucket company. You need to start considering these different items just because in the event, the worst-case scenario happens, another pandemic rolls around and you're not heavy on capital or liquidity, you're going to be in a bit of strife.
And also too, when you are considering everything you've just said to consider, make sure you speak to someone who has a vested interest in your interests and not theirs. So the biggest thing is, I think a lot of these people have good intentions. They go and they'll speak to someone who says they can do this, and they'll say, no, go do it this way, when in actual fact they were right, but that person who swayed them the other way really took them on the wrong journey. So always talk to someone who really understands and, knows the intricacies of Australian expat tax, not expat tax. Because as you said, a lot of these firms, they'll have 40 nationalities of expats. They're not specializing in Australians. They'll look after Brits, Canadians, Americans, the whole gamut. So when you're talking to people, you need to understand what their motivation is and what yours is as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose one thing I did want to just re-mention, obviously, ladies and gentlemen, it's tax time again back in Australia.
Yes.
So obviously it's come to the... we're in a new financial year now, so I hope you're all sort of starting to get together or summarise, maybe your rental properties, your main residence, your rental schedules, all those sort of things, what you're going to be claiming, tax deductions, if you've got HECS.
Depreciation allowance.
That's right. If you've got HECS, unfortunately, we can't escape that. So if you didn't know about that, they changed the legislation 2 financial years ago, whereby regardless of where we are, we do need to make a repayment on our HECS. And it's a percentage of our income. It's not a percentage of what our remaining HECS debt is. So as an example, if I'm in the Middle East, if I'm in Singapore and my annual income is, it's a good wicket, it's 200,000 or 150 or 100, whatever, I will repay anywhere between 5 to 8% of that income on my HECS. So people get a bit confused about that, but it means, okay, if we're not heavy on liquidity right now and we've spent all our cash or we've put our cash in property or investments or bonds, that payment's going to come along. There are options. We can put down 10% of the outstanding debts in terms of what that financial year's HECS repayment is, and then we can put ourselves on a repayment plan. But you need to navigate that through an accountant. So just bear that in mind as well.
Yep, No, I think that's a great place to leave it at. You know, I think it's something that we'll be doing more work with on the social media and on the channels like the podcast and YouTube, with other things to consider over the coming weeks in the new financial year. But so we don't monopolize people's time, I think it's a great time to sort of round it up there. We've covered everything off, and next time you'll see me, I'll be back in the office after our home quarantining. We'll have a new view, which would be good again. And look after yourself, and we'll see you on the next episode.
No worries, Brett. Thanks for your time, mate. I'll speak to you very soon.
Cheers. Thanks, Matt.
Cheers, Matt.